49 and STR 18. Is there someone in Anchorage, Bill Cook, are you ready to testify?
Yes, I am, Senator Pinto.
Please go ahead, Bill.
Thank you, Chairman Ray, Senator Pinto, and other senators. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this resolution, this bill, and opportunity to go first since I have an engagement in a few minutes. I would first like to say that I will not discuss the philosophical or jurisprudential questions of the exclusionary rule and the question of excluding evidence. I'm going to take the position, at least for the purpose of this hearing, that evidence should only be excluded from a criminal trial on the basis of its appropriate value or whether it's likely to be truthful or not, and not on the basis of some technical or otherwise violations of the United States constitutional rights of the defendant. I'm sure there'll be other testimony regarding the philosophical basis, but that will be the position that I will be taking. Commenting on the bill and on the resolution, I would say that up until today, I'd only had the opportunity to read Senate Bill Number 49, and I had some problems with that, which I'll get to in a moment. And arriving here today, I've now read the STR 18, which is brief, I think, and to the point. I would say that the basic problems I have with SB 49 is that it seems to be directed toward evidence that is excluded by reason of some fault in the search warrant or otherwise in the search that resulted in the evidence being seized or in some evidence being seized that indirectly resulted in other evidence. And I'm sure that most of you there probably follow that, but a good example would be where some faulty search warrant resulted in a firearm being seized from the premises of the defendant, and then the defendant confessing upon seeing the search of the firearm, and then that confession being deemed to be the fruit of the poisonous tree or whatever, and the whole ball of wax being thrown out. I'm not going to get too technical on that, but I do believe that the bill seems to be directed towards searches, although it perhaps leaves room open for other type of excluded evidence. And as you know, there are many other types of excluded evidence, probably mainly confession-type evidence. And I would just bring one recent case to your attention that I think is a good example of this. There is a recent case in 32 Criminal Law 1066, which is, of course, just the synopsis of it. Case is apparently Brewer versus Williams, 430 U.S. 387. I'm sorry, Williams versus Nix, decided January the 10th, 1983, by the United States Supreme Court. I'm not going to get into all the details of synopsis, just to say that in that case, the defendant was arrested for homicide and was en route with the detectives to another location after he had been warned by his attorney, and after the police had been warned by his attorney not to talk with him, which is certainly a clear constitutional right. And en route, the detectives talked about the right of the victim to have a Christian burial, and the court earlier found played upon the sympathies, religious sympathies of the defendant, and he apparently led them to the body. Evidence was obtained. He was convicted. In an earlier opinion, the, I suppose, the body and that evidence was thrown out, but in this last trip to the Supreme Court, the indirect evidence the confession was thrown out, but in the last trip to the Supreme Court, apparently, the body and the other evidence was thrown out. The point being that this was not a matter of a search, and I guess it had to be labeled be a matter of a confession, and I was somewhat disturbed that SB 49 seemed to be taking that tack. And I would recommend that you look very carefully at last year's 97 Congress House Resolution 4606 by, I believe, Congressman Collins, which did not pass, which is a very brief bill in the United States Congress, and I think was based upon the Fifth Circuit decision of, I don't have it with me, but I believe it was United States versus Williams. It might have been Harris. I think I'm getting those two confused. But regardless, it's my understanding the Fifth Circuit of the United States has ruled that evidence, at least in federal courts, will be excluded only when it was a result of an intentional violation by the police officer. And of course, that is the, seems to be the intent of SB 49. And also SJR 18, where it speaks in line 22 about the good faith beliefs and so forth. But I would say that if the bill itself was more general instead of getting into a lot of detail, such as reasonable suspicions and so forth, which frankly leave some excellent points of attack by this attorney. So I think I can say that, being one myself, present time, that if the bill is more simple and followed the congressional bill, that it might be more appropriate. Now, maybe this has already been looked into by the persons who authored the bill and worked on it, but I would recommend if it has not been looked into, that it be looked into. The second question, I suppose, is what is going to be the deterrent to police officers if they know that only a bad faith is something that's shown in court to be a bad faith or an intentional violation would result in their evidence being excluded. Now, apparently this has been dealt with in SAR 18 by the constitutional creation of an action for civil damages against the peace officer. I am not making any strong recommendation at this point, and I'm sure that some people might consider this to be inflammatory, but of course the whole subject is inflammatory. I would just say that someone might want to look at the aspect of deterring police officers by giving a right to sue the officer and seize his pension in the lawsuit if it's found that he intentionally violated constitutional rights. Now, I can imagine what the result of that would be, but it's something maybe could be thought about for a few minutes. Anyway, I would suggest that that would be probably, realistically, a much stronger deterrent than to know that if it was uncovered that there was an intentional violation, that the case might go down the drain. I've had some experience as a prosecutor and as a judge and as a defense attorney, and have been around police officers in all of the for about 13 and a half years, and I know that most of them hate to see their evidence excluded, whether it's in a traffic case or first-degree murder case or whatever. But I would propose if it had a direct financial impact, a long-term financial impact, not just a short-term judgment that was perhaps uncollectible anyway, that there might be an even greater deterrent. And after all, I know I'm dipping over into the philosophical aspect, which I don't intend to do, but it's hard not to do in this subject. After all, the idea is to put evidence in before the jury if the measure of likely truthfulness or probative value is there, and why not determine some other fashion. I'd also commend to your attention a book called Exclusionary Injustice, I believe, which is in the possession of the House Judiciary Committee, and perhaps is in the State Law Library down there. It is here in Anchorage. It's been some time since I've read it. I think there's several ideas in that book about other ways to approach this. That is about all that I would say. Well, one other thing. Having said one probably inflammatory thing about the pensions, and I'm just saying that should be looked at, I'll say one other thing that would equally inflame most defense attorneys, and that is that maybe the courts would not strictly apply this non-exclusionary rule if it was still found that the Alaska Supreme Court or the courts here could more strictly interpret the United States Constitution than the U.S. courts do, which has been the holding here. So perhaps the only long-range solution is a constitutional amendment that says the courts of Alaska shall interpret the United States Constitution substantially the same as the United States Supreme Court. Now, of course, you shouldn't hinge it to some of the lower federal courts, but the United States Supreme Court being nominally the final law giver as far as the Constitution, perhaps the Alaska courts should follow that. I'm not talking about Alaska's Constitution at this point. I'm sure there'd be a lot said following me about the privacy amendment that was enacted about 13 years ago and how that would might go fly in the ointment on this. I won't even get to that at this point. I realize that last business that I said about the constitutional amendment might be somewhat inflammatory, but here it is as something to be thrown about anyway. I know that that's quite a bit all at one lump, and I appreciate the opportunity to go fast, or go first, and also go fast, and I had another appointment. Bob will go off here now and answer any questions or hear any comments that might be made. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Is there any questions from any members of the committee? Mr. Cook? No. Not hearing any. Thank you, Mr. Cook. And I would like now to move to Fairbanks, where Mr. William Shindell would like to testify as soon as possible on behalf of the Tenenbaum Valley Bar Association. Is Mr. Shindell present?
Yes, this is Mr. Shindell.
Please. Please proceed.
I'm appearing at the request and in substitution for Judge Hugh Connolly, local district court judge, who is the chairperson of the legislative committee for the Town of Valley Bar Association. At the February 4th meeting of the Town of Valley Bar Association, the subject of SB 49 came up, and the Bar Association voted unanimously to refer the matter to the legislative committee for it to take a stand. The legislative committee has taken a stand, and I'll present that at this point. The legislative committee requests urgently, seriously, the committee to defer any action on SB 49 until the United States Supreme Court resolves the matter of Illinois versus Gates. The legislative committee takes that position primarily for economical reasons, both time and money. The committee is concerned that if SB 49 passes and the United States Supreme Court decides not to amend the current exclusionary rule, that there will be a number of convictions that will be reversed and must be retried at a cost of both time and money to the public and to the court system. However, if the committee decides to resolve SB 49 or the Joint Resolution 18 prior to a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Gates case, the committee requests your committee to consider the following four points before acting on it. First is that the bill will require an extension or an extended period of time in an evidentiary hearing to consider whether or not the police officers acted in good faith and with a reasonable basis. Judge Connolly himself is particularly of the view that the court system with its current personnel cannot handle that additional amount of time. Second of all, there is a problem regarding the definition of, quote, technical violation, unquote, in Senate Bill 49 that the committee believes should be cleared up. Third of all, the bill, and I imagine the resolution, though I haven't seen a copy of yet, appears to reward ignorance and lack of training with regard to police officers. Fourth, again, and this is a matter that Judge Connolly himself is primarily interested in, or interested in very much, and that is that the attempt of the legislature to control the procedural aspects of trials before the courts appears to him to be a serious invasion of the separation of powers concept. Again, the committee's wish to be sent down to you is that we wish that no action be taken on this matter until the Gates matter is resolved by the U.S. Supreme Court, but if action is taken, we see four serious difficulties with the bill as it's currently written. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to respond to them.
Any questions from the committee?
Sir, this is Senator Ray. You said that economically there would be a goodly portion of cases would be reversed. If that's what I heard, I don't understand what you meant.
If it turns out that the U.S. Supreme Court decides not to modify the current exclusionary rule, but in the meantime the Alaska legislature has decided to modify it, the evidence that will have been admitted in the state courts will be in violation of the federal rule. And upon appeal, those convictions will be set aside, and then there will necessarily have to be retrials, assuming that the prosecutors will want to retry those cases. And so basically, there will be a number of cases, though I can't tell you how many, that will have to be tried twice, and with the accompanying loss of time and money.
And the judge that you keep referring to most sympathetically is Judge who?
Judge Hugh Connolly from the district court here in Fairbanks, who is the chairman of the legislative committee. He's been a judge here for 27 years.
Thank you.
I might state, this is Senator Page, I'm Mr. Schindel, I might state that I think it's the sense of the committee that the preferable way to approach this problem is through Senate Joint Resolution 18, which would, if passed, put a constitutional amendment on the general election ballot in 1984, and I think we're of the opinion that that Illinois v. Gates case will have been decided by that time, so we don't think that's going to be a problem.
That makes sense.
Very good. There's Sergeant Tom Culbertson from Kodiak is online. Are you ready, Sergeant, to testify?
Yes, sir, I am. I'd like to begin by reading a brief prepared statement from the department making a couple of additional comments.
Excuse me, Sergeant, would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, this is Sergeant Tom Culbertson. I am here representing the Kodiak Police Department.
Thank you.
First of all, I would like to begin with this prepared statement. The exclusionary rule is without question a vital component of our protection against unreasonable search and seizure under the Fourth Amendment. As such, any restriction on its application calls for the most careful consideration. The problem we have seen with many recent decisions under the rule has been that they do not appear always to have been subject to the same standard of reasonable behavior and good faith applied to other aspects of the judicial process. This legislation appears to articulate that standard in a way which has long been needed. It requires specific reference to the circumstances surrounding each decision and a determination of the reasonableness of actions taken. This can only serve to strengthen, in our opinion, the rule and its underlying intent, that of the protection from law-abiding citizens from unreasonable search and seizure, as well as from criminal attack. In addition, I'd like to just make a couple of comments on the previous testimony. First of all, I would like the opportunity to take issue with Mr. Cook's suggestion that under the joint resolution, Senate Joint Resolution number 18, that officer pensions be included and somehow taken hostage to civil actions under that resolution. I think this would be a most, I think this is a most unfortunate suggestion, and I think I can say without reservation that the certainly the law enforcement community would oppose any such measure. I would also like to take issue with Mr. Shindell's suggestion that the measures as drafted seek to reward ignorance or lack of training on the part of police officers. We don't see that as being the intent of these bills. Quite the contrary, we see this legislation as introducing a standard of judgment in decisions under the exclusionary rule, which has long been lapsed. In that connection, we would certainly like to applaud the officers or the authors of this legislation and lend our wholehearted support.
Thank you, Sergeant Culbertson. Are there questions from the committee? Hearing none, I guess we can turn to Anchorage. We have Jeff Feldman and Bill Bryson. Would either one of those gentlemen care to testify?
You have a question?
This is Jeff Feldman in Anchorage, and I'll be preceding Mr. Bryson, I believe. This is the first time I've had occasion to testify before this committee, and I feel I should give you some background for those who have not I've not met before. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Anchorage, and I've practiced in Alaska since 1975. I clerked for Justice Edmund Burke of the Alaska Supreme Court and previously worked for the United States Attorney for the District of Oregon, which I'm sure you recognize is charged with criminal prosecution at the federal level. I'm here today to testify against the joint resolution and against the Senate bill, as I strenuously object to erosion of the exclusionary rules for reasons which I'll try to make clear here this morning. There are two policies which are served by the exclusionary rule. One is the deterrence of constitutional violations by police officers. The other is that it has been generally viewed in the law that the admission of evidence which has been illegally obtained by law enforcement officers cheapens the judicial system, and that the presentation of such evidence inherently compromises the integrity of the system. The cost to fulfill both of those goals, to prevent the cheapening of the system and to deter unconstitutional conduct by law enforcement officers. The cost is that in some instances evidence will be excluded, and in some instances convictions will be, or the possibility of convictions will be eliminated. Now, in order to evaluate whether the exclusionary rule should be eliminated or not, one, I suppose, needs to look at the extent to which the goals are being served. Is unconstitutional conduct being deterred, and is the integrity of the system preserved? And you also have to look at what cost is being exacted. And I'd like to look at those three factors very briefly, if we could. I know that the committee has previously heard some testimony concerning the numbers of cases which are lost by virtue of the application of the exclusionary rule. I think those numbers tend to be grossly overstated, and for that reason, I think that this type of legislation is a somewhat misguided effort towards trying to improve the quality of justice and improve the quality of criminal justice in the state. Now, to my knowledge, the Alaska Supreme Court has reversed only one conviction in the history of the state where a search was held unlawful because of an invalid warrant. I'm not aware of any other cases in which warrants were issued and the Alaska Supreme Court ultimately suppressed evidence because the warrants were somehow defective. So the notion that large numbers of cases are being lost and washed down the drain because of so-called technical violations in the applications or enforcement or executions of search warrants, I think is simply false. And I would be very curious to see representatives of the law enforcement community come forward with hard data or research indicating that that information is somehow incorrect. If that's true, then I suppose we need to look at the remainder of the cases in which exclusionary rule is applied, and those are instances in which searches are executed without search warrants, and the question generally involves in the court whether or not one of the exceptions to the warrant requirement will apply. Now, to my knowledge, there have been no studies in Alaska summarizing the numbers of cases in which evidence has been lost and convictions prohibited because of the application of the exclusionary rule. I am aware of a study that was done at the federal level, however, in which it was estimated, I believe, if I'm not incorrect, that fewer than 0.5% of all the cases that are prosecuted were ultimately lost because of application of the exclusionary rule. If that figure is similar in Alaska, and I'm not aware of any particular reason why it shouldn't be, then we're talking about a very, very minor number of cases which are lost. Now, admittedly, there are going to be instances in which serious cases, and we can be blunt about it, rapes, homicides, serious assaults, there will be instances occasionally where serious crimes will be unprosecutable because of application of the exclusionary rule. And I know that those are the types of cases, those notorious criminal cases, in which the public wrath is particularly inspired. It has been a fact of life, however, that the security that all of us enjoy by virtue of a strong constitution is, for the most part, enforced and solidified through the enforcement of rights of some of the most undesirable persons in our society. People such as those of you in Juneau, those of us here in Anchorage who are testifying, I suspect, rarely have occasion to enforce our constitutional rights because, for the most part, we are not in a position where we are the subjects of criminal prosecutions. And so, unfortunately, only those who are accused of committing some very detestable acts provide the factual and legal context within which the matter of constitutional rights are litigated. I'm not aware of any solution to that particular problem, but I think to overreact to the numbers of cases as compared with the value of preserving a strong constitution is a serious error. There's an additional point that I'd like to make, and I'm not sure how to put this in legal terms, but as I'm sure that the committee realizes, the Alaska Supreme Court has been particularly vigorous for many, many years in enforcing constitutional rights, and even more so, I suppose, particularly vigorous in enforcing search and seizure rights. That is not just a product of the particular judicial bent of those various members of the court that have sat on the court from time to time. In point of fact, the existing Alaska Constitution contains a search and seizure provision which is broader than the federal Constitution. And I think that if we look back at the state constitutional convention, we will see that clause is a product of what has historically been a very deep concern about the role of the individual and the role of government in this state. And one of the things that has always been dear to my heart and to those many others, I suspect, is that Alaska has always been a state where the rights of the individual were paramount. This was one place to get, not to wax poetic or to lapse into Jack London, but this was a place where the rights of the individual were deemed very important. And to that extent, the role of government and the right of the government to interfere or intrude upon the rights of the individual was carefully circumscribed in the Constitution. We're now talking about taking legislative or constitutional steps that would be aimed, for the most part, in eroding some of the strength with which the Constitution has been enforced over the last several decades. I think that's an unfortunate step, and I think it's contrary to the Alaskan philosophy, to the extent that there has been one since statehood. I don't know what that particularly is a product of. I suspect that it may be a product of the fact that Alaska is a somewhat more cosmopolitan state than it was 25 years ago. It may be a product of the fact that our problems are somewhat different than they were 25 years ago. But I think it would be a tragic occurrence if we were to conclude that our society has changed so much that we can no longer afford to have the liberty and the freedom and the atmosphere, the legal atmosphere, that apparently was prevalent at the time of statehood and has served the state, fairly well since that time. To summarize my comments, I think that the exclusionary rule serves a valid purpose. I think that elimination of the rule does far less in terms of allowing for additional prosecutions than its proponents would suggest, the proponents of this bill would suggest. I think the cost is minimal, and I think that the benefit is substantial to the rule, and I think that the committee should give very cautious consideration to what the overall impact will be on the Alaskan fabric of society by making such a serious change in the constitutional rights of its citizens. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Thank you, Mr. Feldman. Are there any questions for Mr. Feldman from the committee? Seeing none, I'd like to move around. I think we have someone in Sitka, Charles Stewart. Do you care to testify, sir? We can hear you fairly well. If you'll speak up a little bit, I think we'll hear you all right.
Yes, sir. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm Charles Stewart, Sitka. I'm associated with the Libertarian Party. I'm kind of young. I'm 28. But I'm truly concerned about the erosion of basic principles set forth in the Constitution, both state and federal. I feel that those principles were set forth, well, especially on a federal level, for specific reasons. Back before the Revolution, the Founding Fathers were extremely apprehensive of the power of the king. The king had very close to dictatorial power, and that was the basic principle behind having a constitution. Totally go to the extreme of calling their heartfelt writings, which they embodied in the Constitution, technicalities. Line 23 of our Senate bill states only a technical violation of the defendant's right. This seems to me to be a quantum leap in the legislative process. You know, 100 years ago we were legislating in sincere regard for to guard against powerful bureaucratic structures that would oppress the rights of individuals. And here today, we're calling them technical violations of defendants' rights. What my real question is where are we headed? Possibly I've been reading some material that is a little bit over-emotional or something of this nature. That's, you know, it's like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. Maybe it is over-emotional, maybe it isn't. But the erosion of the principles embodied in the Constitution, I believe, the Constitution should be looked to as something sacred. There are people, I don't know whether I should include myself in one of them, but they believe that the Constitution is a divinely inspired document. Now, we're supposed to be one nation under God and all this kind of thing, and I'm really borderline atheist myself. I don't know whether God exists or he doesn't, but to take these people's feelings that wrote the Constitution, our founding fathers, so lightly, I really feel that the police officers that are proposing this type of legislation and the legislators involved in it are really unaware of the basic principles of what they're attempting to bring about. I believe that about covers what I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. I don't see any questions in the committee.
I would make a comment if I could.
Please comment if you want.
I would think that the witness who just testified would not be classified as an atheist because he doesn't deny the existence of God. He's merely uncertain about it. That makes him an agnostic.
Moving along to Fairbanks, I believe there's someone ready to testify. Mary Green, would you like to testify at this time?
Yes, thank you, Senator Pettyjohn, and members of the committee. I'm appearing in place of Walter Scheer on behalf of the Alaska chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. In addition to the comments of the ACLU, I have some personal experience and philosophy questions, which I'd like to also testify. As this committee is no doubt cognizant of, there may be significant constitutional problems with this bill. We, like Mr. Shandell, who testified earlier, encourage that passage of this bill wait for the decision in Illinois begins. Additionally, since the measure or constitutional amendment could not possibly go on the ballot this year, we suggest to the committee that there's time to study the issue, and we urge that the legislature use this time in this way. There are no studies in Alaska regarding the issue of the exclusionary rule. However, other studies show that the perceived problem that a vast number of people are going free because of the exclusionary rule may not in fact be as widespread as some think. I'd like to call the committee's attention to two studies, one of which was just referred to the committee by Mr. Feldman. There's a recent study by the Comptroller General of the United States entitled Impact of the Exclusionary Rule on Federal Cases. I believe that the study was issued on April 19th of 1979. This is a study of 2,804 cases in the federal system, in which some of the major results are that 0.4%, less than 1%, of the cases there were declined prosecution because of Fourth Amendment search and seizure problems. At the cases that are going through to the trial court level, there was only 1.3% of search and seizure motions. Of those cases where search and seizure motions were in fact in whole or in part granted, 50% of the people charged were still convicted. I think it suggests that, in fact, there aren't those hordes of people who are out there who are going free because of this bill, and that therefore the cost may not be as high as some of us may have thought. The second study that I'd like to call to the attention of the committee is one very recently done by the National Institute of Justice called The Effects of the Exclusionary Rule, released in December of 1982. This study concerned California cases between 1976 and 1979. The study showed that 4.8% of felony arrests were rejected, prosecution was rejected because of search and seizure problems. An interesting note is the fact that of those that were rejected, 75% were drug-related, not crimes of violence, which naturally calls attention to the exclusionary rule and sometimes causes public uproar. I'd like to also share the fact that from my personal experience, which includes over four years of practice that's been devoted exclusively to criminal defense work in Alaska, there are very few cases which result in dismissal because of the exclusionary. I myself have handled or been connected with literally hundreds of felony cases. And my experience is that of those hundreds, there have been two dismissals based on Fourth Amendment problems. In light of those studies and experience of bar in general, in Alaska, the ACLU urges that the legislature request that the Alaska Judicial Council study the question and fund such a study prior to actual consideration of this bill. Depending on what the Judicial Council finds, we may find that the cost is not great. I'm as well head of the Appellate Department of the Public Defender Agency here in Fairbanks, and I have a personal concern about the cost of this bill in terms of the appellate process. Up until there is a final ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court in Illinois v. Gates, and depending on that resolution, final resolution by the Alaska Supreme Court, we're literally going to have havoc in search and seizure. Because the reticence on the part of some judges to actually express a finding when a search and seizure motion is denied, we're going to have an awful lot more cases going up on appeal on that issue. I think that's a result that's not good for anyone, including the general population. I'd also like to express a concern that I have as an individual, which is not necessarily the opinion of my employer or the Alaska Civil Liberties Union. My greatest concern is the effect of this bill on the law-abiding section of society. Individual rights guarantees to all people in society the right to be free, not just, they don't run just to criminals. This bill, in my opinion, encourages police not to know the limitations imposed by the Constitution on their actions. If police are encouraged not to know the law, there necessarily will be more unconstitutional interferences with the freedom of innocent citizens. The Fourth Amendment standards are there to restrict unjustified police interference in all of our lives. If the police are encouraged not to know what constitutes actual probable cause for seizure of the individual or probable cause to search, then there will be an increase in unjustified intrusions on the rights of individuals who have done absolutely nothing wrong. That result diminishes the right of all of us to the freedom which we enjoy, a right which, as Mr. Feldman said, is one that is especially enjoyed by the people of Alaska. Thank you. I'd like to thank the committee for their time and would answer any questions.
Thank you. This is Senator Ray. I appreciate the information on the National Institute of Justice, but I was sorry that you didn't carry through and mention that the cases by counties that showed an alarming difference of, you stated the 4.8% of felony arrests. Well, in San Diego County, the rate was 8.5%. In Pomona, it was 11.7% and 14.6% in a sample of all of the central operations. I also found you were correct when you stated that 71% were arrested because of drug charges. In Pomona, 31.6% of the felony drug arrests referred to prosecution in 1981 were rejected because of the search and seizure problems. And most interesting also in this study was that most defendants arrested and later freed because of the exclusionary rule. That arrest was just a single incident, and approximately half of those freed were rearrested during the follow-up period. Some 981 in one place of 2,141 defendants not prosecuted for felonies in California in 1976 and 77 because of the exclusionary rule were rearrested within 2 years of their release. So we appreciate your testimony, but when we have the further facts here, it does give a little different shading on some of the figures you gave.
Just to comment briefly on that, Senator Ray, thank you for filling in the rest of the figures. I think that the major thing that must be learned from those figures is that there are vast differences among areas. given the, my personal experience as well as the experience of defense attorneys who I know well, I would suspect that in Alaska, if the legislature would choose to request the Judicial Council to do a study, that we would find figures that are much lower than those in California. And the figures that you quoted, I think, do show that there are vast differences in various areas. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Green. I'd like to move to Ketchikan, if we could, at this time. And I believe Chief Dan Anslinger is there. Are you ready to testify, Chief Dan Anslinger?
Yes, I'm here.
Would you identify yourself, please, and proceed?
Yes, my name is Dan Anslinger. I'm Chief of Police of the Ketchikan Police Department. I originally came to this teleconference not to testify, but just to listen. However, after listening to some of the testimony, I decided to change my mind. First of all, I believe that relaxation of the exclusionary rule will be of assistance in law enforcement, albeit I think it will be a small one. In the past 4 years, the exclusionary rule has negatively affected two Ketchikan Police Department cases in court. Unfortunately, both of those were major cases. I don't believe the relaxation of the rule is going to have a major impact on either crime or individual rights, but I think it will help close some of the cracks that some of these things fall through. I'm a strong believer in individual rights, and I don't want to see any of those eroded. There apparently is a serious concern that if one of these bills passes, that police officers are going to run rampant on people's rights. First of all, I think we need to reflect on the fact that, on one hand, many people are saying that the exclusionary rule is only affected in 0.5% of cases, which I think may be an accurate figure. On the other hand, the thing that should be kept in mind in this is that those are criminal cases, and we're talking about constitutional rights of individuals. As the law stands presently, if a police officer commits an illegal act, the citizen has every right to sue that police officer, and that frequently happens. That's not going to change. That's the biggest deterrent, in my mind, to misconduct of police officers. Another point that I would like to make is that I don't believe that anywhere in the Constitution, either the U.S. or the state constitution, is there a right to commit a crime and get away with it? We are still going to train our officers. In fact, I feel it will have a greater burden to train them because the judges are not going to simply accept the word of a police officer that he believed that he was doing right. We're going to have to prove it. In summary, I support the passage of the Joint Resolution Number 18. I think it's the appropriate way to go. I feel that by putting it on the ballot for the people, that will, in effect, delay it until the U.S. Supreme Court issues their decision, which is expected before April. And I think that would save a lot of problems in the future with court battles that many people are concerned about, and rightfully so. Thank you.
Chief, this is Senator Ray. Do you know offhand what the status of the Shamrock case is at this particular time?
Which one, Senator?
The Shamrock case, and isn't it the Shamrock Bar in Ketchikan?
Well, the bar was closed last Saturday by order of the ABC Board. There's still a civil suit pending against the city and the police department resulting from that case.
Was there any references to illegal search and seizure in those cases at all, sir?
The criminal cases that were brought as a result of that search had absolutely no problems with search and seizure. Those people, with the exception of one, have completed the court process, I believe, and have been convicted. One was found not guilty. The civil suit that results from, or that is pending right now, is a result of searches that were made and no criminal charges were brought.